Oh, hey, didn't see you there. Welcome to Secondary Fermentation, episode number 79.
79. We're feeling fine.
Feeling fine.
And we're not drinking wine because this is a beer podcast. So yeah, that'd be.
I'm drinking wine.
A little bit out of place.
Barley wine.
Barley wine.
As usual, this is Joe, and I'm joined by
Nick.
And we don't have Elsie today. She did not do her homework, and she was unprepared for the assignment. So she is sitting this one out.
What is that TikTok trend that's maybe gone now, but it was like, she understood the assignment.
Yeah.
Or they understood the assignment. She did not.
Dang kids with JK. Their TikTok trends.
Yeah.
Their Tic Tacs and their...
their My Books and Face Friends and...
Now, old people definitely know about Facebook.
Yeah. I feel like
detrimental sometimes.
Yeah. I keep seeing things about like the old Facebook. I think it's from the old Facebook where like all the different notifications you would get, like just the layout of it.
Oh,
log in and it's like you've got like new friend requests, new posts, new comments, new whatever.
Yeah.
It's like all kind of layered. I think it's from that, but I'm also thinking it could have been from MySpace because it didn't show like the header of the website. It just showed like
a
little box where you'd get like all the notifications kind of layered.
No one
will remember how exciting it was to like log on and see like all those notifications.
And everything was on your feed in chronological order. There was no algorithms pointing content at you and stuff. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. But while we talk about nostalgia, why don't we crack a beer?
I am reminiscent for a beer.
I'm reminiscent. So we have a beer. This was actually another beer sent by Matt Griffo. He sent us from Bastet Brewing. This is a Bloodlust.
Ooh.
Cracking of a beer.
Yeah, another one of the Tampa Bay Beer Week releases, so... Oh, thank you, sir.
Cracked it open. It's puffing up with a nice pinkish foam. Smells a little sweet. Bloodlust is a sour, fruited sour. 4.3% ABV and 2 IBUs, according to Untappd. This beer, being a sour, what would you think the blood would be in the Bloodlust?
I would think blood orange, but it's also like not a sour... more just a citrus fruit, so I don't know. It definitely, I mean, on appearance, it's got a really
sweet,
vibrant red orange color to it.
Very sweet aroma too.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah, it does. It, you know what it reminds me of when I'm looking at it, though? Like, not quite as reddish pink as strawberry soda, but it's pretty close.
Ooh.
Like, it has like a strawberry soda vibe, kind of.
I went ahead and tasted it. It's pretty tasty.
Ooh.
Yeah. Very sweet.
Let me get some coconut.
Yes.
Like a ton of coconut.
Definite coconut.
Which is not what I was expecting to detect.
Well, the Untappd description says it's inspired by the shaved ice flavor of tiger's blood.
Oh.
Which makes so much more sense now. Watermelon, strawberry, coconut, leaving you dreaming of a Hawaiian sunset.
Hawaiian sunset.
I feel like this beer would be a great mixer.
Put
some rum in it or something.
Yeah.
You maniac!
You're mixing beer with liquor.
Never sicker.
Yeah, it's interesting because like by the look of it, I mean, it's got a little bit of some... It looks almost like a little bit of pulp in there. Maybe some leftover particulate matter. And then it was really like bubbly... Like effervescent at first with the carbonation.
It's smooth.
But it's
out
slowly
a lot.
It's totally just smoothed out and it's now just like a kind of placid looking reddish orange color. But also then like the aroma smells really sweet. I don't get a ton of that like tropical fruit aroma, but then the coconut comes in really strong up front
like,
when you're tasting it.
The nose is kinda like strawberry and then like that coconutty kind of vibe. It just got that coconut is just a very distinct smell to it.
Yeah, this would be a great like summertime beer, just like hot weather beer. Because again, you think about like shaved ice, that's pretty synonymous with being outside on a warm day at the park or at some kind of, you know, local town event where they've got food trucks and things lined up. You go to the shaved ice truck and get something to cool down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really not tart at all, but just a really, it's like a nice hot weather beer.
Yeah, and the can actually, the can art on that Bastet can reminds me of, it's got some like Egyptian cats and things that reminds me of, you know, kind of the last episode of the podcast where we talked about beer and ancient civilization. So kind of funny. Maybe we should have pulled that one for last episode, but didn't even really think about
Egyptian
it.
Egyptian beer. Yes, they had watermelon, strawberry, coconut sours.
Yeah.
The Egyptians were crazy about making slushy beers.
Yeah, they were not into none of that gross pale ale type stuff. They were into really high adjuncts with fruit flavor and something refreshing.
Yeah, little known fact is that 450 North is actually in Egypt. Just crazy stuff, you know.
Yeah, the more you know. Yeah, so another great beer. This is the second one we've had on the podcast. We've got some more to try. Probably won't do them all on air, but thanks again, Matt, for sending these up. And definitely be recommending this one to anybody that's from the Tampa Bay area. Go to Bastet. And this might be a kind of limited release. Not totally sure based on it being, the can it was in was a slim 12-ounce can, and it may have been something that was a limited release for that Tampa Bay Beer Week, so.
But yeah.
Definitely really, really nice, really nice one.
Other beer events coming, if you're in the Raleigh-Durham, Cary Triangle, Research Triangle area of North Carolina.
You're in the parallelogram of the Raleigh
area. if you're in the octagon that is the Raleigh area, Brewglue is back. Brewglue went last year. Nick volunteered last year. Nick is volunteering again. Sadly, I'm going to be out of town because it's a great festival. Kind of two festivals in one almost. Sponsored by Shop Local Raleigh. Really put on by them and a lot of good stuff there, but is it the first night is like the block party, am I right? Where you basically kind of do your traditional pay a fee, get unlimited pours type festival. And then the Rulu Fest the next day is kind of a ticket-based operation where you can get samples with tickets or full pours or whatnot. And you're volunteering for Saturday, right?
So we won't be making it to the Friday, which April 26th, just to clarify the date. April 27th is Saturday for the kind of like the all-day ticket sampling portion. But yeah, we're going Saturday morning to help us set up. And last year it worked out perfectly because while the setup part was not the greatest weather, we had some rain. We luckily got good weather by the time it was pretty much wrapped up and the event started at noon. So definitely a fun time to go check out what, you know, North Carolina has to offer as far as craft breweries. It is the largest craft beer festival in North Carolina. It's actually the second largest in the U.S. in total, so it's definitely a big deal. And according to the website, it's been voted the number one best beer festival 2 years in a row by USA Today's 10 Best list. So
damn.
You know they're doing something right. And it's a very, like, Shop Local Raleigh, I learned last year, is a pretty small organization that puts on such a large event. They do it through the grace of like good sponsors and having people chip in and having, you know, a lot of volunteers come in. It really takes a village to get this event to go off as smoothly as it does and to have as many accolades. Yeah. So if you're in the area and want to volunteer, they still need people and they'd be happy to have you, and you can get some good swag. They usually give out a t-shirt for the event. You get some tickets and things to either use for the Friday event or the Saturday event, depending on which shift you're signing up for. So, but also just, you know, feels good to contribute to such a cool event.
Yeah. I don't need any more swag. I'm already full of it.
You're just dripping in
beer merch. I got that drip. You know, there's one thing I always say, if it's not rated in the top 10 by USA Today, I don't know what it is. There was another beer related event thing that we also called out that was rated by USA Today. And I'm just like, how random is USA Today rating these beer things?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I feel like we're lucky to have that so close to us, and definitely don't want to take it for granted, because I don't think I really went to it until last year. Might have been the first time I even stopped by for either of the days. And so now that I have experienced it firsthand, it's one of the cooler beer festivals I've gone to. And yes, the beer shirt is cool. I still wear it from time to time from last year, but it's more about just having the accessibility to all that delicious craft beer from around the state. But yeah, you know, going back to t-shirts, I think at some point I'd like to have all of my t-shirts consist of beer related swag, either from a brewery or from a beer festival. I just want to get rid of all my other t-shirts. I don't need them.
It's a good idea. Just ditch them all, burn them.
Every time I buy a new craft beer related t-shirt, I'll just throw out one of my other ones I don't wear anymore.
Yeah.
Circle of life. Well, I'm gonna throw it out. I'll donate it, but
burn it.
Burn it.
But yeah, you know, I just finished up my sample. Apparently I'm drinking faster than Nick. Now I made him chug it. But I was gonna say, we can crack open our next beer before diving into the topic, which is a continuation of our little bit of a history of beer. Which last week, as Nick mentioned, we talked about pretty much ancient beer to the conception of these fermented beverages that was first considered beer way back, almost 13,000 years ago at points. And we're going to talk a little more modern, you know, from the Middle Ages up to about the Industrial Revolution at that point, which there's kind of a lot of stuff that happened within beer. But first, let's crack open our next beer. This one was also from that European beer pack that I got from Costco. This one intrigued me, though. This is Rotmistrz, is a product of Poland. And on the can, it says India Pale Ale / Lager. So I don't know what it is.
Well, which is it?
What do you got?
It's more lager than pale ale.
Yeah. So we'll see. It's got a very, you know... It's got some words on there that I cannot say because Polish is incredibly difficult. Oh, shnikes.
Another foamy boy.
One foamy boy. Oh, that was a crispy audio pour.
You could probably hear like how foamy that is.
It is. I have to top up again because I had so much foam.
Yeah, I know. And we weren't even pouring aggressively on purpose. It just kind of happened that way. Yeah, really tight packed micro bubbles, really creating a thick, fluffy, cloud-like head of foam here.
Yes, it's like one of those foams where if you like mine right now, if you pour too much, it comes up and over the rim of the glass and just stays as like a little floofy, fluffy cloud. Not running over, just shooting straight up.
Yeah, I mean, it looks almost tightly packed enough that it's like you could balance something on top of it.
Yeah, this is one that would give you a mustache.
Oh yeah, for sure. But otherwise, underneath is a really clean, bright gold beer. Looks mm-hmm. really delicious. So
yeah, clean and clear, nice tight white foam.
Interesting nose, because for something branded as an IPA / lager, I'm getting a lot of like Belgian yeast smell and like kind of like more like a Weitz style beer, maybe a weedy beer, kind of like that yeast from the like Weiss beer family or like a Belgian style.
When you said yeast from the, all I could say is east in my head.
Weast.
The yeast from the east.
The weast from the east. Yeah, it doesn't smell like I would expect from a beer that is categorized or how they're
as an IPA or a lager. Definitely has more of a Belgian vibe to it. Very interesting. I wasn't sure what to expect with this. It's got a bit of an identity crisis.
It's saying it's like one of two things, but it doesn't taste like either.
It's both.
It's like they were like, we're going to cover our bases and use two different beer styles on the can, so that way we...
On the opposite ends of the spectrum.
And it's like, and you're somewhere in the middle.
This actually is a triple dry-hopped hazy IPA and an imperial stout.
Interesting. Yeah, it would have been hilarious if it poured like a really dark brown.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, so it has a pretty clean, crisp flavor. It is light. I mean, it's closer to a lager if I'm having to lean one way or tip the needle between IPA and lager. It's more towards a lager, but it definitely has tons of like yeast character, which is not common with a lot of lagers.
I wonder if it's supposed to be like an IPL.
Mm.
But like, not.
Yeah. It does finish a little bit bitter. Mm-hmm. Like I'm having like a bitter sensation.
It's not bad. It's just confusing. I think that's the biggest thing.
Yeah. I mean, if this is like an LC pick, we would be way off for sure based on what they're saying it is and what where our heads would go. Because I know immediately I'd be saying this is some kind of like vice beer or by the time I looked at that, I probably changed my mind because it's not hazy. It doesn't have that kind of characteristic haze or unfiltered appearance from a lot of the
be like a crystal vice beers.
Yeah, Crystal Weizen would have been a good one. That would have been sick if we would have guessed a Crystal Weizen.
I know, right?
Yeah. It's my dream if someday I can just nail a pick like that, but...
Yeah. Oof. But yeah, and it's funny how persistent this foam is. As I drink it, it's just going further down into the glass, leaving a lot of lace. This beer pack, you know, I've had a few this week after work, just like cracking open a lager. I'd say it's been fine. I've not been incredibly thrilled with it, and it was like $26 or $27 for 12 beers. Was it? I don't even know if it was 12. It might have been 10 beers, and they've been good. I mean, there's been a few lagers. The lagers have been pretty crisp and clean. They've been very heavily malted, though, like extremely heavily malted lagers, which is fine. Just wasn't really what I was looking for. I mean, there's been a couple good ones in there. I think those French ones that we had were pretty decent. A couple of the lagers were, you know, all right. Nothing I would be like, this is amazing.
Well, it's kind of like the Costco beer advent calendar. I mean, a lot of those beers were, after a while, kind of...
The same.
Kind of the same, yeah.
Oh, man, after Succession.
So many Kolsches, so many like German Pilsners. And then
it was like, day 9, Kolsch, day 10, Kolsch, day 11, Kolsch.
And then one day it was like they threw in... was it a Rausch beer?
Rausch beer.
And then they had, they did have an IPA in there somewhere, but
there was a dark one too.
Yeah, but definitely like a malt forward type of beer package. So, which I guess is, you know, not super surprising when it's coming from Europe, but
yeah. But speaking of Europe,
perfect segue. We nailed the segue today.
Boom. Speaking of Europe, let's hop back in time to a little time I like to call the 13th century. I'm the only one who likes to call it that. That was not a good segue.
Could have called it anything you wanted. Well, no. I mean, it's accurate. So, yeah, 13th century.
Little thing I like to call.
Do you ever get, like, a hard time trying to, like, when you go by the centuries, I always forget that, like, the 13th century... is technically the 1200s.
Yeah, it's.
I always have to think about that because I'm like 1300 or 13th century, so we're talking like 1300. I'm like, wait. It's
12.
Like 1201 to, or 12 to 1299, and then the new century starts after that. I find that to be confusing.
Yes.
I don't know who thought of that, but terrible.
Yeah.
Like right now, we should be in the 20th century. I feel like we're in the 21st, and it's gonna. Oh, I won't. See the 22nd, so
maybe advances in medical technology
preserve us.
Did you ever see those like TikTok videos? It's like people are like, can you believe now that children like born today have a very good chance of being alive until the year 3000?
I don't think a very good chance.
In just 80 years, it's going to be the year 3000.
Oh, no,
That's bad,
yeah. But even though we can't preserve ourselves until 3000, there was something that was introduced in the 13th century that did help do some preservation.
I knew that was coming.
I'm trying my best here to bring in another good segue, but I think we should have just, you know, should have just been happy with the first good segue, and now we're trying to overachieve. But yeah, so 13th century, we're looking specifically in Germany, where beer, as we talked about, the kind of the last episode, we tailed end with, you know, beer becoming a really big part of German culture, and they really adopted the beverage and took it in wholeheartedly, whereas a lot of other civilizations at the time were maybe more prone to use, to enjoy wine as the staple beverage. Yeah. That was a higher class beverage. But Germany, they practiced a lot of brewing, and around 1200 is when they really introduced hops as a vital ingredient to the beer recipe. It had been experimented with before. Some monastic breweries had introduced it because, you know, they were throwing in different types of spices and other adjuncts. But the Germans in 1200 really started to use and lean on hops as a vital tool for beer. And it kind of created what we, you know, now think of as like modern day beer. That was kind of the landscape for that. So it helped with like preservation was a big one.
But also like just flavor.
Yeah,
like
absolutely. You said,
it changed it to what beer is kind of today. And, you know, prior to that, beer was made with a whole bunch of different things and a lot of herbs, a lot of spices, just a variety of like flavoring.
Something to
agents.
Give it flavor. Yeah. Barley water is just not going to taste like anything. Yeah.
Fermented barley water. Yeah. But, you know, they were given all sorts of things and for medicinal purposes and whatnot. And beer was kind of like a sweeter beverage, but it spoiled pretty quickly. And like you said, hops were, you know, a great addition because not only do they give a nice flavor, but they also have that, you know, preservation property as well.
Right. I have to imagine they were trying to just add in things that were going to create flavor characteristics and add to the quality of the beer. And that
they decided.
Yeah.
They're like,
And then they maybe accidentally learned that the lupulin oils and hop cones had that antimicrobial property. I can't imagine somebody looked at that and was like, you know what? That inside of a beer is going to stop bacterial growth.
Yes. Like, we don't know what bacteria is, but it will stop its growth.
Yeah. As far as like beer goes, this is like another instance where I feel like everything was kind of just accidentally discovered or fallen upon. So.
Yeah. But more durable beer, better preserved beer, means you can now take it with you places and you don't just have to make it at your house and drink it real quick. You can do that. But it also led to transport and sale of beer. Because if you've got a product that lasts more than a few days or a week or two, you know, you can really start to make a bunch of it and make some money off it.
Yeah. Well, before, you know, the beer in England in like the early Middle Ages around like 1000 AD, the ale houses there, they were basically for on-site consumption, or you might fill up a jug and take it home, but you were kind of drinking it within a couple of days. Like there just was no storing of it without it spoiling or perishing and becoming disgusting. So pretty nice now that you have the option to transport it, bring it to places that maybe didn't have easy access to it, and in turn, you know, increase the opportunities for economic growth and trade routes and another good to trade with. And so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you could use, so you, as you begin trade and doing these things, you start to be able to make beer and sell it in places where maybe the ingredients or, you know, hop varietals or, you know, malts that were available in one area, not available in another, making it, you know, kind of desirable. But also, as urbanization started and people started living together, you know, there were alehouses, like you said, in places that sold beer in small breweries. They started to become popular and they became, you know, really like a defining feature of urban areas. And like you said, economic development came because, you know, people needed to work at the breweries, one, and taxation was huge. A lot of cities developed on the taxation of beer and beer sales. And when you start making more beer, you need more ingredients. So farmers and whatnot are busier making the barley, making the hops.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, kind of with the, you know, a tie into the last episode talking about the domestication of grains. It's like, well, now we have domestication and it's even more credence now to, like, you know, produce more job opportunities and using land for increased production in that grain. But also, like, with hops, we've talked about this in some previous episodes where we dive deeper into hops, but, you know, as we know, hops grow at very specific latitudes in the world, and so conditions have to be kind of perfect for them to thrive. And so, again, kind of taps into that need to be able to transport it, because if you're in an area where hops just won't grow well, you don't have access to the kind of the beer that we know now with hops as an ingredient. So that was pretty impactful that they were able to discover the properties of preservation from the hops, because now it reaches a bigger area. Like a lot of Northern Europe was getting beer transported. You know, a lot of the German towns that were on the Baltic Sea, they were able to then, you know, ship out things across the waterways to different countries. So we have, like, you know, the Netherlands starting to get beer. Bavaria starts to get beer. Of course, they're shipping German beer to England, who's already making beer, but now they're getting German style. So a lot of change there just from that process of kind of expanding trade routes and using beer as like a staple with like exporting, importing mm-hmm. of goods. So
yeah, and it's interesting to see how that beer train, you know, like you mentioned some cities in Germany, like Hamburg. Hamburg was producing in the year 1360, kind of a mind-boggling amount, about 25 million liters of beer.
That's annually. Lot.
That is a lot of beer, especially if you think about like 1360 when there wasn't things like refrigeration.
Yeah.
Or thermometers.
And the population comparison to now, like,
yeah.
I wonder what the per capita was. I think it's got to be around something like 300 liters a person, I think I saw.
Yeah, I saw that. It was around like a liter per person per day, or three quarters of a liter per person
which is
per day.
Probably about right for the amount of consumption they were
yeah.
having with beer at the time.
And that's a great segue into the, you know, thinking about the medieval times. And, you know, we've talked about it, even in the last one, we talked about beer safer than water to drink. And that kind of leads one to think, well, beer is the primary beverage of the time. And it's true that beer during there, you know, during those times was a lot lower alcohol content, making it, you know, a little safer to be drinking on the daily in that capacity. But it's even so, you're talking about a liter a day. That's quite a bit of beer every day per person. But there was some, you know, myth that surrounded just people just drinking beer all the time. And really, you know, during the Middle Ages, there are plenty of records that show saying that water was plentiful and accessible by many. And even so, water supply systems were development, and people got penalized for messing with that water, contaminating mm-hmm. with the water. So even though there was a lot of polluted water, they still worked to create water sources that were safe and available for everyone. The thing with beer, though, beer was drank so commonly because it was a nutrition staple, pretty much. It was a nutritious alternative, providing calories and, you know, nutrients that were needed, especially in laborers and, you know, people that were doing some hard work.
Yeah. And, you know, while we have mentioned that the beer is more similar to the modern day beer that we're used to now, the alcohol content was still pretty low at the time. Especially in England, you hear things like small beer.
Got a small beer.
Yeah. And it's just basically, I mean, it's what it is. It's just a low ABV drink that could be anywhere from 0.5% to maybe a couple percent ABV. So while, yes, people are consuming maybe a liter or so a day in addition to water, like, you know, it's not affecting their, it's not giving them the same level of intoxication that we would have with
ability
that
to
much.
Operate heavy machinery. AKA horses and ox.
Yeah. I wonder if OSHA was around back then. But yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we talked about how beer was kind of a class or lower class beverage at first, but Germany, with, you know, the introduction of hops and kind of increasing the quality of beer through preserving it, having it, you know, cleaner tasting, improvements to water access. So they're constantly having good ingredients and having just a cleaner product. And then over time, it grows to become a more culturally accepted and widely used and consumed beverage. And so it becomes really popular and accepted across a lot of Northern European countries. And so with that is, you know, obviously a big shift in culture and how civilizations work. You know, Joe talked about kind of the infrastructure changes too. But yeah, I mean, it was really vital to a lot of things culturally, but also with civic actions, and including things like the water access and laws against, you know, contaminating the sources of water. Yeah, I mean, so you see things like an increase in the number of breweries too. There's a lot of growth, especially in Germany. And it becomes actually a pretty male-dominated industry after, you know, we spoke more about it last episode, where women were instrumental to beer production. And then even up until, you know, the early 11th century, in the Middle Ages, women or the alewives were primarily the ones making the beer or the ales that they were distributing to you know, neighbors and townspeople. But now that it's becoming so widely accepted and spread and the growth is kind of booming, there was a shift there where now the men are kind of taking over that industry and women are kind of excluded from it, which is a pretty drastic shift from what the norm was up until that point.
Yeah, because really, I mean, like starting really flourishing in the 13th century where those alehouses and really just kind of having a local place that you can get beer right around the corner. And since, you know, hops were just starting to be in production, you know, people were like, hey, I'm enjoying the convenience of having this beer right next to my house. It's pretty great. And they would go in and do that. And the alewives were pretty much, you know, they'd make beer for their house. They'd make a little extra. They'd sell some on the side. Or, you know, if there was a widow or, you know, something like that, they would use these alehouses to make some money and sustain themselves. So women were super important in the development of beer kind of as we know it. But as things started to scale and there was money to be made, men butted their way in and, like you said, kind of excluded women. And even up until like modern times,
which is
pretty sad, you know, women have been relatively excluded out of beer.
Yeah. Well, and it just kind of shows the, you know, the history that men have with, like, at the, you know, before beer was as popular and as big of a cultural fixation for people, it was kind of like, oh, you know, the women can do that. Like, that's an alewife's job. But now it's like, oh, this is vital to the growth of our, you know, economies. And it's, you know, we're exporting this and it's like super important. So now the men want to like get in there.
Yeah.
And it's like kind of how a lot of things work, sadly, is like, as soon as it's a big deal, it's like men want to be involved and kind of
take over. Yeah. Pieces of junk.
Yeah, we can, you know.
That's why Elsie's not here. We kick her out.
she's fuming about this still, so.
This is a man's only podcast. We booted her. Yeah. Oh, man. But yeah, so that happened, you know, and then things started to spread. That with alehouses came some regulation around there. There was a lot of beer regulation that was put into place. You know, one of the big things that happened in the 16th century, the year 1516 to be exact, was the Rheinheitsgebot, which basically said this is the German beer purity law. If it's not made with these things, it's not real beer. And that was hops, water, and barley.
Barley.
But there's one crucial beer ingredient missing there. That's because they didn't invent it yet. They did not invent it. They just didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
They just were like, the magical beer.
Yeah. These things come together and it just happens.
It just happens. Put them together and it happens.
Yeah. Ignorance is bliss.
It happens.
Yeah. And there's also, you know, I know Britain had some laws, which actually kind of come into play a little bit later too, but they had very similar laws as far as like restrictions on what ingredients you can use to make beer.
Yeah.
And so that kind of thing also kind of came over eventually to the States with kind of the colonization of America, but not as, you know, they kind of basically just brought over the European and the English practices of beer. And as we also know, this is kind of a, you know, conversation for another time, but around the world, like other places were finding out the joys of fermentation and like distilling things kind of.
The joys of fermentation. Yeah. That could be a shirt there.
The joys of fermentation. That sounds like a Bob Ross. Like, we need to have like a Bob Ross of beer. Like, where he just hits, you know, talks very softly and has a perm and, you know, just has a show where it's on PBS. But yes, I mean, they, you know, all around the world, different civilizations and countries were doing things on their own with, you know, like China making like rice wine and, right, you know, using rice as a fermentation vessel, and then even the Native Americans, they were, you know, using corn and other types of grains to kind of ferment using different fruits and things. So, you know, the colonists kind of came over to the U.S. and brought what they knew, but they also had to find ways to adapt because they didn't have the same access to barley initially. And, you know, we talked about that a little bit with the pumpkin beer episode in our podcast too. They used things like pumpkin and they used corn and maize just to try to find a way to ferment and just
get those fermentable sugars.
Yeah, and just, you know, and now we kind of think a lot about, like, you know, the big macro breweries and their the domestic pilsners we drink. It's like you kind of get that corn flavor, so it's kind of reminiscent of that too. But so that kind of kind of wraps up, I think, a lot of just the transitionary period between like 1200 to, we're kind of looking at like the end of like the 1700s. There's a lot of this kind of ramping up of beer, but then kind of comes to a point where it's like, well, we're growing, but we have not the means to, you know, produce it as fast as we want, or as efficiently as we want, or store it as efficiently as we want. So,
and I think up until this tipping point, you know, as we talked about in the last time, beer really led the change of civilization and kind of influenced the way that civilization worked. You know, it led to people settling down to grow grains. You know, beer served as an economic growth factor through breweries and, you know, taxation. But I think once we hit the tipping point of the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century is really when we started tipping the scales and influencing beer, I think, from that perspective. You know, we started to with the sale and the addition of hops and being able to transport it more, but the Industrial Revolution really changed beer as a cultural staple into a commodity, I think, through just factory-like production and sales and business in general.
I think that's a really good point.
But yeah, so I really, up until this point, beer was made a lot of manual processes. You know, for big productions, there's a lot of horsepower, just actual horses powering machines and things. But really, in 1765, there were significant enough improvements to the steam engine that actually breweries were able to use it. They were able to increase their efficiency and have cost savings, and basically kind of reinvest in their businesses and build further and expand their production. You know, brewers were able to operate on a 24-hour per day basis, which they previously hadn't been able to do. And, you know, over time, they started getting more technology and even, you know, even more things. They had things like thermometers and hydrometers, which are, you know, two relatively innocuous things that we see now that you don't realize didn't exist until a few hundred years ago. And you're just like, wow, how did you not, like a thermometer? Like, you think of all the things you do with that, especially in the brewing process. And then the hydrometer being able to actually measure alcohol content and know pretty much everything before must have just been like, take a sip. Yeah, that's about strong enough there.
Yeah. That's what the ale tasters were for.
The ale tasters.
Which just seems like an amazing job. I wish I could have. Wish they still had ale tasters. I guess they still do in some degree, but they're working in the breweries now.
Exactly. But there's a lot of technological advancements. So steam engine, like we said, they started installing them in the 1770s, 1780s. The thermometer was invented in 1760, hydrometer in 1770. The drum roaster, which is another big advancement, because if you're talking about roasting malts or malted barley, you know, if you're cooking it over an open fire, some of it's going to get burnt, some of it's going to be, you know, overcooked, it's not going to be even. But the drum roaster really allowed for that even roasting without burning the grain, so you're able to get darker beers without them tasting like straight smoke.
And that, you know, I mentioned a little earlier about like the British laws too, when we were talking about how they enacted laws in these European countries about beer purity laws. So in Britain, I read that in 1816 there was a law that only hops and like malt could be used, obviously water too, but as far as like the the product you're putting into to make the beer, that was all that could be used. And so by actually using like wood chips or charcoal or straw, whatever, to like burn and then like roast your malt, it's actually like kind of against the law at that point. And so it made it difficult for the folks trying to make porters and have these like dark roasted beers. So with the drum roaster, it now enables people to roast the malt into the desired level of char and roast without having any of that kind of like adjunct smoke flavor added to it.
Yeah.
It's also crazy to think that I don't think I read anything about this until we got to this point, but I have to imagine a lot of beers had that like smoky flavor,
yeah,
at least underneath like a little bit of a smoked flavor
or really like green flavor,
unless they weren't doing any kind of roast, if it was just a pale malt and they were keeping it and just doing a pale malt grist
or just letting it dry out on its own,
right?
But it's crazy because, you know, also part of those purity laws were to really stop people, because it became a business and you know, bad things happen in business all the time. and people that are trying to make a quick buck or cheat people out of stuff would put in these fake ingredients or like these things that would maybe modify the color, but they could be toxic, you know, all sorts of stuff that they would put in to make it counterfeit. Because, you know, it's not the cheapest ingredients in the world. So people would do whatever they could. They would cut beer. That was another problem with ale houses that was pretty rampant was the deliveries of beer. They would just like dump a bunch of water in them to really cut them down. Oof. So there was a lot of regulation that happened around there as well, where people are just trying to, you know, take advantage and scam some people out of some stuff.
Yeah. Well, they would have hated the inventor of the shandy. Like, I'm going to cut this beer with some lemon soda.
You son of a...
Wait a minute. But actually, that turned out to be a pretty monumental, pretty popular choice too. So
yeah.
But yeah, definitely a lot of large contributions to beer from those inventions. And at the same time, there was people that were actively working on things to improve some problems that were identified with mass production of beer that also have like impacted the world at large. A couple of those big things would be the process of pasteurization from Louis Pasteur, who was a scientist studying kind of microorganisms. He was actually the one who identified through microscopy that, hey, there's yeast in beer, proved it and said that, you know, the yeast is actually alive in the beer and that this mm-hmm. is what causes the fermentation that eats the sugar and creates the alcohol. And so, again, going back to the Reinheitsgebot, we have the kind of amendment to that where now it's like, okay, yeast is part of that because it has to be there.
I guess you can use it.
You know, they can relent that there was something else going on. But
which is why, like, to think that every beer to that point and beyond, to some degree, was all wild strains of yeast.
Yes.
Or, like, you know, local strains mm-hmm. of yeast that they had, like, they were able to do starters or something with. I don't even know how they did it to make a consistent product.
Well, and I wonder if that also contributed largely to how low the alcohol content was. It's just if you don't have, you know, a ton of yeast introduced to your wort, then, you know, there's not much of that fermentation going on. And so they were able to achieve a pretty low ABV volume.
Yeah, and how hardy the yeast is and everything. I mean, the yeast we have today, you know, the laboratories dedicated to certain characteristics of it, you know, is it able to eat up a bunch of sugar and survive high alcohol contents? Is it able to do high temperatures, low temperatures, the speed of fermentation, the, you know, byproducts of that fermentation to create different flavors? Just so much that is variable with yeast, which is pretty cool. We probably should do an episode on yeast. That would be, I don't think we've done one yet, but there's a lot I think to talk about with it.
Yeah. I mean, there's like entire QC labs that some large craft breweries mm-hmm. have, like New Belgium and Sierra Nevada have their own labs where people are, you know, they're working with like the same yeast strain and they're able to kind of through, you know, different processes, like keep one strain alive or test like how, you know, how active
and
a certain yeast
is. And not have it mutate like crazy and stuff. It's nuts. Is it White Labs that there's a, they actually have Nashville? A tap room. There's a tap room that White Labs have that like they brew the same beer but with different yeasts, and you can basically kind of do a flight with different yeast. So that would be really interesting to have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so yeah, that was a monumental discovery as far as just a world discovery, but for beer, that was huge to have that kind of on the stage and present to everybody. Like, hey, this is a part of this process. And mm-hmm. Recognizing that, hey, it's active and it's going to ferment, and that, you know, with this product, there's a risk of the introduction of bacteria, which was, you know, deemed like they knew beer couldn't survive long periods anyway, but that was just because it would spoil or it would taste bad after a while. And even with hops introduced, you know, they're not able to kind of keep, like they weren't practicing probably the same sanitation techniques we would be aware of now. And so this was kind of Louis Pasteur's big contribution, I think, is like the process of pasteurization, which we now maybe liken to milk or like dairy products, but is actually kind of more widely devised for beer. And like, how do we keep beer from being infected and then becoming a bad product? Because when you have things like yeast, which is, you know, it's a fungus and it's like eating stuff to make alcohol, it's like you also want to not introduce anything that's going to be a contaminant. And so that's where we kind of get the process of like, we heat the wort to a certain temperature, which should kill off potential bacteria. And now since then, there's a lot of other sanitation mm-hmm. techniques, but that was a pretty big part to make beer even more, more of a prolonged shelf life by having pasteurization as a technique or process for beer.
And pasteurization's gone through waves too. It's like fallen out of favor, you know, like crap. None of the craft beer that you have is really pasteurized. And that's why you have exploding cans of IPA or fruited sours. But, like, you know, all the macros are pasteurized, and the pasteurization process, they say, you know, affects flavor, but it's like heating it up to like 170 degrees for however many seconds. Yeah. So it may have some effect. But I mean, during that time, pasteurization was just a huge medical advancement. Like,
oh yeah, sure.
Just to crazy.
Keep things from, you know, you're getting sick from the stuff you're consuming. Another thing that was a big problem that, actually was the solution was devised by a brewer from Germany that worked at Spaten. This was the problem of, now we're mass producing, but we don't have a way to keep this product chilled, or we can't produce enough ice, or we don't have enough space in cellars to kind of store beer and keep it, mm-hmm. you know, cold. Because temperature is a big part of keeping beer from getting spoiled too. You can't have your beer at a really warm temperature because it's going to...
Well, especially if you're lagering fermentation,
So we had a problem, and so around... the 1870s, Carl von Lind, who from he was working with Spaten Brewery in Germany. He was the founding father of what's kind of the modern mechanical refrigeration system, which could produce ice by machine, which at the time was such a novel concept. And so while that was a huge benefactor to beer production and keeping beer stored, chilled, and lagered at the right temperatures, that also led the way to just widespread mechanical refrigeration, and people were able to store meats and things at home. It was kind of the groundwork for that. And so,
which is a very, it's a controversial, like, who invented refrigeration, or who used the first application. Cause like on quick searches, you know, you can see some, there's one that says, Alexander Twining, an American businessman in 1856 is believed to have started commercial refrigeration. Mm. And it says by 1861, a dozen of his vapor compression refrigeration systems were in operation in breweries and meatpacking houses. So
interesting.
Because and then if you look on another one, it says history of brewery refrigeration became in Vienna in 1870 with Carl von Lind.
Yeah. Well, it's I think there's a lot of that with beer history. We've found that where there's people that kind of want to have the claim to fame, and so especially with the more ancient moments in beer history, there's, you know, especially some of the early monastic breweries, there's a lot of maybe contention about whether things are valid or not. Mm-hmm. Like the oldest breweries in the world, we talked about that in another episode, and it's like, you know, you're using maybe, you know, tax documents or some kind of journal writings to find out like the validity of those statements. And so definitely there's been other instances in beer where it's like, which of these is actually the most reliable source?
Who did it?
Because it's obviously you want to have like your claim to fame, especially with something as culturally as impactful as beer. So,
oh yeah,
yeah, interesting. I'd seen another video too where like I think there's somebody else where they actually talk about like the actual refrigerator and not just like kind of like mechanically produced ice. So definitely an area where there's probably some dispute still.
Yeah. Just a lot of stuff in the Industrial Revolution that led to just major impacts in what we think of commercialized beer today. And really the production increased dramatically, and just the availability of beer, which just, you know, was everywhere, and really became just a part of modern society. And that's the way it operated for a while. And same in the U.S., you know, mm-hmm. people came over, brought brewing techniques, you know, a lot of, as we talked about in our oldest breweries episode a little bit, with some of the original, like, big names that came over for what we think of domestic beers now. Actually, a lot of, you know, German immigrants and whatnot, but just beer went on for a bit, kept evolving, and then probably for our next topic, or our next segment, we'll talk about Prohibition to the modern era of beer. Because Prohibition, I think, was just a big knock backwards in what happened with beer, as you know, there was just so many breweries around and very, very few survived Prohibition, as we talked about in our oldest beer episode. Is just a few survived by making either just unfermented malt beverages or near beer.
Yeah.
And you know, some converted to making sodas for a while and random things, but just a big, huge, you know, everything had been building up, and then in America Prohibition hit and the American beer culture kind of just...
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think it'll be interesting to kind of dive more into the events that led up to Prohibition, what kind of led the US lawmakers to enact that, and then kind of the aftermath and the effects of Prohibition. I think that's a lot of cool factoids there, in addition to, you know, kind of the post-Prohibition world, how that shaped the US beer industry as well. Definitely a pretty dense area to talk about. It deserved its own spotlight, I think.
All right, Nick. Well, I think that wrapped up our progression in our next phase of the history of beer. And there's only one thing that's next in our history. It's Elsie's Pick of the Week.
Why is it in the history?
It's next in our history.
Our history. Because technically anything that happens after this is our...
Is yeah.
Well, no. Well, history's in the past, so it's in our future.
This will be in our history in about 10 minutes.
Interesting.
And Elsie is here for the pick itself.
I am. Assume the position.
Cracking of a beer.
This beer's about to be history.
Yeah. Wow. Just hit me in the face with a glass. I'm scared.
See, this is the danger of having your eyes closed. You can't tell when someone's going to rock you in the face with a pint glass.
She must have gave it to you after she smacked me in the face with it.
Whoopsie. Ooh,
got my nose a little bit wet. A pleasant hop aroma.
Pleasantly hoppy. Is it an IPA lager? Yes, it is quite hoppy. A little dank.
Yes, definitely leaning resinous, kind of pine, dank character.
I like the description. You know, it's like, it's dank, it's musty. It smells good. Definitely hoppy. It's a tiny bit of vegetal on the, like, retro-nasal olfaction there.
Absolutely.
A little bit sweet too, malty.
Yeah, pretty well balanced. It doesn't lean like totally just bitter. I'm getting a little bit of the malt character through to kind of add some complexity and sweetness.
I'm thinking it might be hazy. I'm going to take a peek at it.
Yeah.
It is hazy.
Decently hazy.
Has it got chunks in it?
I don't know, but I did not
eat it. No chunks. Would you make a full glass? And I've got like... Oh man,
I'll share.
Not bad. I mean, it's like a New England IPA. Kind of on the sweeter side, I think, for me.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's malt derived or just like juicy thiol.
So yeah, I don't think I'm gonna waver from hazy IPA / NIPA.
Yeah, decent collar of foam that's been persistent on it.
Yeah.
I think it's just a nice, decently solid hazy IPA.
Yeah, I could see there being some, like, I don't know if I say, maybe some Chinook hops. Maybe Idaho 7.
Maybe some...
Strata.
Motu Eka.
I'm just naming hops at this point.
I think it's definitely, you know, like a... Saws.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'll say, or maybe Simcoe. I think I'm gonna say, I'm gonna guess Simcoe is my hop. If we can find it.
The sweetness is throwing me off a little bit.
There could be Citra in there. It's just like. Yeah.
That's what was. I was almost getting like a New Zealand-y hop kind of vibe, but.
Ooh. What if this was a New Zealand IPA?
A Nzipa.
Nzipa.
Oh, yes.
Does it say?
No, I'm not gonna.
All right, what's the beer?
Wait, aren't you supposed to tell me?
We're guessing.
Well, we can't. We gotta guess the brand and the name. That's.
What did you guess?
Nipah.
It is not.
Hazy Paw. How is
hazy
that?
Hazy
Paw. Yeah, Hazy IPA, Nipah.
Hazy Paw.
Hazy Pale Ale.
Alay.
No way.
Is that why it's sweet?
It's a Hazy Paw.
What is it?
What do you think it is?
Beer.
Oh, yes.
Hazy Pale Ale. Is it a North Carolina brewery?
It is.
Is it more east North Carolina, or is it
more
west?
West.
More west? Central? Yeah. Triad? Raleigh?
We'll say easty.
Okay.
East.
Is it Wilmington?
Yeah.
Well, that's ooh, pretty east, right?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about where we're curling.
Oh, yeah.
Was
church.
Like, was that more east than
more
west?
East. It's kind of south.
Yeah.
Well, Wilmington's almost not
Wilmington
directly south.
Brewing but. Company? Bills Brewing?
Mm-hmm. Bills? From Bills?
Bills, not Wilmington. I said those very close together, and I said Wilmington Brewing Company, and then I said Bills. This Bills. Oh, is this, what the heck's the name of it?
It was the Merc Master Flex.
Merc Master Flex. Well, there you have it. Elsie failed to stump us. Probably one of the easiest. Actually, no, she did stump us, because we said pale ale.
I was like, you're rewriting history now.
I history is written by the victors.
I was like, did we sit through the same thing?
Sorry, I forgot
that
it was not an India pale ale.
Yes.
Elsie has thwarted us once again.
So tricky.
Once again, I am asking for... yeah, she's coming out with the tricky ones lately. Really getting us things that we think should be slam dunks. She's wrecking us. Yep. But that's the name of the game, and that's the name of the episode. Nick, what'd you learn?
I also learned that the hydrometer and the thermometer were invented relatively close together.
Yeah, they were very closely.
That was pretty enlightening. I don't know why I didn't think about the hydrometer being that long ago. Like,
yeah,
I feel like it. Seems like it would have been more modern.
Seems like invention. You'd want to figure out temperature first.
Yeah, because I guess I'm trying to think. I'd have to look up other applications for a hydrometer to see.
I mean, you could use it for anything you're trying to get specific gravity type stuff on. So it could be useful in a lot of other applications, but very close together. And I think what I learned is probably that I was shocked that the thermometer was not invented until the late 1700s. I thought it would have been a little earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of crazy stuff. So I think I learned a lot researching this episode. You know, there's lots of good articles out there if you want to check them out. And, you know, this was a nice learning experience episode. But yeah. If you learned something, let us know. Reach us out to us on social, Secondary Fermentation on Instagram, Facebook, East Carolina Beer and Brewing. You can send us good old-fashioned electronic mail at eastcarolinabeer@gmail.com. Hit up our website, eastcarolinabeer.com. And as always, have a great beer drinking day. Like I always say that every time, you know?
As we always say,
have a great beer drinking day. Just in a time that I like to refer to as the 21st century.
I don't know what century we're in. I can never keep up.
But cheers.
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 Bye.
Cheers.
We'll see you in episode 80.